Hello. I hope you are having a good Halloween night. This is the first episode of many of the new Aggie Radio podcast, Beyond the Archive. Today, we are discussing something of a local legend. Some of you may have heard of it. I have. The Nunnery. Up the canyon? The place you don't really want to end up late at night. Today, we have a special guest. One of the professors of Utah State, actually. Lisa Galbert. She'll be talking to us.
So, you said the legends of nuns, like, and pregnant nuns are super old. Like, how old are they?
Well, as you know, the idea of pregnant nuns is kind of an important part of the folklore complex, you know, surrounding St. Anne's. But there's a lot of ideas that surround the folklore of St. Anne's. You know, when I first started learning about it, that's what my students would always tell me was, oh, there was, you know, that it used to be a nunnery up there and the nuns were pregnant. But not just that they were pregnant, but that they would actually, you know, murder the babies. And so there was this, you know, idea of infanticide, you know, up there, that the nuns would somehow got pregnant by priests who weren't supposed to be up there, and they were drowning their babies in the swimming pool and things like that. And that's kind of the basis of the folklore about St. Anne's, that swimming pool is really important. And then, you know, some of the other folklore is that if you go up there at night, you can hear sort of like the cries of these murdered babies, if you know, that have been drowned in the swimming pool. And I got really interested in kind of that cluster of ideas about nuns, the fact that they were pregnant, the fact that they were supposedly murdering babies, you know, drowning them in the swimming pool and things like that. Because obviously nuns are, you know, they are a religious order and they are dedicated to service and love of God, right? Mm-hmm. So I started researching those ideas and where they came from. And it turns out that this idea of pregnant nuns dates back to the early Middle Ages. So it's a really, really ancient folklore idea. And I think it partly has to do with the fact that nuns traditionally, you know, wear a habit. So they have robes and then they have kind of a wimple on their hair. So they cover their bodies because they're, you know, a religious order. And I think sometimes it makes people wonder, like, what's underneath the robes? What are they hiding? You know, maybe they're hiding a pregnancy or something like that. And you know, you can find in, like Dante, for example, in early literature, you can find kind of ribald references to ideas about people sneaking into nunneries and having sex with the nuns and getting the nuns pregnant and things like that. So it's kind of an old, like a really old joke or a really old idea that got kind of imported into the Cache Valley area and then placed on St. Anne's. Now, I think it's important to note that St. Anne's was never a nunnery. Like, that is also part of the folklore. It never actually was a nunnery. It was owned by the Catholic diocese. And there were, it was mostly a, like a spiritual retreat. So the Catholic diocese has orders of nuns, and they're, for example, I think the Order of the Holy Cross, they used to operate the hospital in Ogden. Yeah, when I can't remember which hospital it was now, but one of the hospitals in Ogden was a Catholic hospital. And the nuns were all nurses, essentially. That's what they did, was nursing. And they used to come up to St. Anne's as kind of a retreat. It was, you know, their way of having a little vacation and a break from the hospital. So St. Anne's was never a nunnery, but it got reconfigured to be a nunnery in the folklore that started surrounding St. Anne's. But, you know, it was fascinating to me that idea of pregnant nuns, and even also the idea of nuns murdering babies, is quite old as well. And I think it's because, you know, nuns are associated with children in a lot of different ways. Like, they are celibate, so they do not have sex and they do not have children. And so then, of course, when one takes a vow of celibacy, everyone kind of wants to see you break it. So I think there's a little bit of that goes, you know, way back to the medieval period. And You know, nuns traditionally have run orphanages, you know, so they are associated with the care of children, even though they do not have children themselves. So I think that's where some of those ideas come from. But it was very interesting to me. I had no idea when I started, you know, writing for that, doing the research for that article, that idea went way back. And then here you have it in Cache Valley in, you know, very modern era, kind of recontextualized, you know.
Yeah, that's so cool. So you said the swimming pool is super important. So I have a question. We didn't talk about this in the email, but like, how many stories do we have of people drowning their children? Because I'm instantly thinking of La Llorona.
La Llorona? Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That is that. I actually talk about La Llorona in that article too. So you made a great connection. Yeah. Well, there's all kinds of stories about murdered babies, right? Because a murdered baby is a very tragic thing, obviously. And you can find stories, and particularly babies being associated with water, you know. So the story that you're referring to, La Llorona, is a story about a mother who drowns her children. And then there's various reasons given in the different variations about why she drowns them. In some versions, she's supposed to, you know, she's supposed to be like the mistress of Cortez, the conqueror, and, you know, drowns her children so that she can be with him. In others, she's sort of just crazy. But then after she murders them, she goes along the river and kind of cries, mis hijos. It tends to be a Spanish tale. And kind of looking for her children. So there's this notion of kind of ghosts and water. But there's also ballads about, you know, murdered children that you can find in folklore tradition. And I think this notion of, you know, the swimming pool in the St. Anne's complex is quite iconic. It's kind of a central piece in that property. That property was owned by a couple of very wealthy families. And so it was very unusual to have a swimming pool when that property, you know, was constructed. And in fact, one time, I went to a monastery in Idaho, in Cottonwood, Idaho, a Benedictine monastery, and I met a woman, a Benedictine monk. So Benedictines can be male or female. You can be a monk and a female. So this was a female monk, and she had been a nurse at that Ogden Hospital and had recreated to St. Anne sometime in the 50s. And she specifically remembered swimming in that swimming pool when the swimming pool was up and running and having a grand time. Like she had never been in a swimming pool before. So it was, you know, like an amazing treat for her to get into one. So the swimming pool, I think you're right, is probably the most common motif, sort of that small little narrative element that comes up in those tales over and over again, except for maybe the pregnant nuns or the idea of the nuns murdering their children. But there's lots of, you know, lots of ideas and folklore that circulate about St. Anne's. You know, a lot of the folklore is actually, I think, quite violent. Some of the tales or some of the stories that have circulated in the past are that they were raped by priests. Some of the stories are that, you know, they were raped and then sort of the nunnery burned down. Again, of course, it was never a nunnery, but that's the folklore about it. Mm-hmm. You know, so I kind of consider this body of folklore somewhat violent. There's a lot of murder. There's a lot of rape. There's a lot of illicit sex, you know, murder of children, things like that.
Yeah, I love this folklore. Maybe that says something about me as a person. But I find it very interesting, like how you're saying there's all this rape and stuff. And I've never encountered that in the archives. Like most of the folklore stories in the archives of this is usually a nun, like a singular nun gets pregnant, goes to the nunnery and is like, okay, I have a kid.
Yeah.
There's a pool.
No, sometimes there's stories in there that the, you know, quote unquote mother superior, of course there was never a person like that, but that like all of the nuns had gotten pregnant. And so the mother superior murders them all. You know, there's the one that I'm thinking of, the particular version about it, them having been, sometimes it's not priests that rape them. Sometimes they're raped just by like, you know, men in the canyon. But the one the version I'm thinking of in particular, I remember it was quite dramatic because when it was burned down at the end, it's almost movie-like, you know, like a horror movie. And then it burned and then they were all gone.
So let's consider the events of 1997. I mean, I don't mean to be indelicate because these were real people and these are real life events and those people are still walking around, walking the earth. And if they hear this, I'm sorry. But like, I've heard tellings where the security guards, and these aren't like the tellings in the newspaper, they're just like the folklore tellings, like the security guards were like possessed by Satan or something.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, what the students were doing, let me back up a little bit. I started teaching at Utah State in 2004. So, you know, 5 or 6 years after that had happened. And that was when I started learning about this legend complex at St. Anne's, which this is what folklorists call kind of a legend complex, is this body of, you know, stories. And my students started telling me, my older sister had a friend when she was in high school who, went up to St. Anne's, was poking around and was ambushed by, you know, the security guards there. And at the time, to me, it sounded like folklore because nobody had directly been ambushed that in my class. It was always sort of like a friend of a friend, you know, somebody they sort of knew. And that, of course, is a folklore idea too. That's often how stories get circulated and validated, is that we hear them as a friend of a friend. So at first I thought it was folklore in the sense of not being true. But then when I learned about St. Anne's a little bit more, it turns out it really was true. And what the students were doing, folklorists call legend tripping. And that means to go to a place where there is already a story. So oftentimes locations and landscapes have stories attached to them, and St. Anne's is an example of that. So there's this complex of stories attached to a particular place and people get really curious, right? So they want to go, particularly if it has to do with the supernatural, and particularly if it has to do maybe with the evil supernatural. People want to go see it. And in a small rural place like Logan, there's not much else to do. So you might as well go up the canyon and see if you can see anything that's happening. And so folklorists call that legend tripping. And that's what those students were doing, is that they were, or high schoolers, I guess, you know, they were legend tripping. But there was probably, I think there were about 35. There was a lot of people up there. There was two different groups that had gone up there that night. I don't think they knew the other group was going, but there were quite a few kids up there. And then of course they were ambushed by the caretaker and his friend in the property. And the swimming pool of course comes up again because they were held at the bottom of the swimming pool with guns, you know, at gunpoint. And I think they were tied up as well. So it was, again, quite violent. You know, it was kind of a violent incident. And I think a couple of the women were groped. So I think there was some...
And it was on Halloween.
Was it on Halloween? I did not know that. Some of the women were groped. I think boys was hit in the head with a rifle butt and ended up with a concussion. So it was a pretty, you know, dangerous situation. And what often happens with legends that is, so to me anyway, so interesting about them is they really kind of bleed into reality. You know, I mean, the stories that we're talking about are pure fantasy. I always have to emphasize that with my folklore classes, because I do have students who believe that there was a nunnery up there and that there were actually nuns murdering babies, you know, and I want to really emphasize that that is totally not true. Like, that is just pure imagination. Yeah, hogwash, imagination. The site was owned by the Catholic diocese. It acquired it in the 50s, and it was a spiritual retreat to which nuns went, but they were not pregnant. They were not murdering anybody. There was no murdered babies. But folklore and legends specifically do tend to kind of bleed over into reality, and reality tends to bleed over into the legends. And that's what makes them a really fascinating genre to study. So what happened with those kids that night is a process that folklorists call ostension. And that means when people go and start acting out the narrative in some kind of way. And I think that's why people go on legend trips, is, you know, they go to a location And they kind of want to see what's going to happen and almost insert themselves in that narrative in some kind of way. And then they come back, right? And they've got their own kind of version or variant of what happened and what they saw, and they get to tell their friends and things like that. And that's what those kids were doing, was this process we call distension. But unfortunately for them, it really got out of control with that that caretaker and his friend. And in fact, there was a legal battle that happened after that. What's that?
I'm pretty sure he lost, and he had to pay a fine or something.
Yeah, I think he did eventually, but it was kind of long. I think it was going the way of the kids. It ended up being more a battle over property rights, you know, and the question turned on whether or not the students were trespassing on private property or not. And it turns out that because it's federal land up there, or national forest, they were not. But it was sort of a legal touch and go for a little while. But then what happens is, you know, you take a real life event there, these kids at the bottom of the swimming pool, right, where those murdered babies supposedly were murdered, right? And you have a really kind of close connect between a real event and that narrative, you know, that's a pretty close match there. And then what happens is those real life events then get incorporated into this larger legend cycle. So for a long time after that, that incident happened, what happened was it really put a damper on the legend tripping because people were too scared to go up there. But then what happened as time passed and people weren't sure whether, you know, the students had actually, you know, whether that had actually happened, that historical event of them being ambushed, that then gets incorporated into the larger narrative about St. Anne's. And of course, what does it do? It encourages more people to go up there and try and see what's going on, right? So it's kind of almost like a feedback loop between narrative and human behavior, and the narrative and human behavior, narrative and human behavior.
It's an interesting thing.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating. Another example of it is another part of this complex is, so in the folklore part of it, right, another idea is that the nuns, and of course the nuns really, like in this folklore complex, they're not really nuns, they're kind of witches. They behave as witches, right?
Yeah. Because
what do witches do? Witches murder babies, they, you know, break vows of celibacy, they have sex with the devil, things like that. So there's a very kind of close relationship to how the nuns are being figured with how witches traditionally are imagined. And in fact, there is part of that legend complex names the supposed Mother Superior as a witch, and it as the witch Hecate is another version. But other pieces of this is an idea that, you know, the nuns also had these hounds of hell, that they had these big mastiffs, and that if you went up there, you could see these dogs and the red glowing eyes, and they were sort of like, you know, hounds of hell and things like that. And one of the things that I found when I was doing this research was that when the sisters would actually go up there, so you have to think about it kind of from the sister's point of view, right? You are a young female nun, you go up there and you have problems with teenagers, right? You have these teenagers coming up to your retreat because they're legend tripping, but you're in the woods, you're up in a canyon, you don't live here. And you're nervous. And really part of the story that doesn't get told is, you know, the nuns were really being harassed. That's really what was going on. Not purposefully, you know, by the kids in any way. The kids were just doing what kids do, but they were going up and they were drinking and they were partying and poking around. But there were people on, you know, like vulnerable women on the property, and they felt threatened. So they did actually at one point get dogs to protect them. And so then what happened was those dogs became interpreted in this folklore complex as being hounds of hell, right? So that's, again, that kind of process of ascension where people take pieces of life and start acting out the narrative, and that kind of, there's a real fluidity there between real life and story. And St. Anne's, I think it's even more fluid in lots of really, really interesting ways.
Yeah, that's amazing. It reminds me a lot of like stuff we did, me and my family as kids. Like, I don't mean to get off topic, but just an example, like my neighbor had this giant fence. It's as tall as their house. I'm not even kidding. It's not even my childhood, like, oh, that's a big thing. No, it's as tall as their house. And I remember distinctly, we were all terrified of these people because one thing, like, I went to get a ball and this lady, like, threw a knife in the ground and gave me the ball. We were all like, they're crazy.
Yeah. Well, kids like danger. They like to play with danger. You know, there's a lot of fun and games involved in it. And, you know, certainly I did my fair share of legend tripping when I was a teen. So I totally get it. And you know, this tradition of legend tripping to St. Anne's goes back to, I think, basically the 1950s. You know, I think it started happening when the property, I'll give you a little bit of history on the property. The property was originally owned by two pretty well-to-do Utah families, the Hatches, whom I'm sure you've heard of. And then I think the last name is pronounced Odlums. It's O-D-L-U-M. And they were people who, you know, made a lot of money in the 20s in, like, you know, in just basically the stock market and, you know, Kodak Camera and Hilton Investments and things like that. So they're incredibly wealthy, and they developed this property. Eventually they moved out of Utah and went to New York, and then they would come to Logan Canyon and retreat at this property. And it had, like, you know, it had the swimming pool, but it had, like, you know, servants' cabins. It had a number of guest cabins. It had, you know, a playhouse where the kids could, you know, perform theaters with, like, a ticket booth. They had stables. You know, it was a very nice piece of property. And then when they no longer used it, you know, I think they had a hard time finding a buyer for it. And one family sold their share first, and then the second family shared. And so then they eventually, the Catholic diocese bought it kind of over a period of years between 1951 to 1953 or something like that. And I think that's when those legend trips started to occur, because I think, you know, in the Logan area, which is highly LDS, having a piece of property with a Catholic presence was a very foreign idea. You know, I think there's some ideas about foreignness that kind of bubble up through all this folklore.
Yeah, like the legend I heard, I guess it's wrong about the property itself, is, like, what I heard is they went to the Mormon church, so the LDS church, and they were like, you want in? The Mormon church was like, nah, we good. And then they went to the university, and the university was like, nah, we good. And then the Catholic church bought it.
They might have. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's entirely possible.
Well, I mean, if I'm assuming it's part of a legend, because I've only heard it from, like, one source, and I can't, like, back it up.
Yeah. I went and kind of combed through the archives in the Catholic diocese to get pictures and kind of, you know, the history, put together a history of what had happened. And, you know, their original intention was to use it as a retreat. So that's when the name changed. It used to be called Pine Glen Grove was one of the names for it. And the other name was Hatches Camp. And then when those families sold it to the diocese, then they changed it to St. Anne's Retreat. That's when the name change happened. But pretty early on, if you go through their notes, they do make, you know, just, and these are, like, minutes from meetings, so they're really tiny little pieces of information, but they do make notes about, oh, be sure the padlock, you know, on the gate is locked in order to ward off, you know, unwanted visitors and things like that. And I think that reference to unwanted visitors is probably a reference to, you know, probably the teenagers in Cache Valley who were curious about what was going on and starting that tradition of legend tripping that continues, you know, all the way up to the present day, really. So it's really quite an old, venerated tradition in the Logan area at this point.
Yeah. So we've talked about so many great things, but I don't know if you've watched it, but I watched it, and I guess I kind of laugh because I learned recently that ghost shows are a modern way of the spiritualist movement, like, coming. Yeah, someone was like, and I was like, ah, yeah, that makes sense. So Ghost Adventures went up to the retreat, and they, like, it was ridiculously framed, like, the way they framed the episode. They had, like, this actress, like, over the pool, and, like, a dramatic dropping of a baby doll or something. And, like, all the time I just was watching it thinking, oh, this is fake.
Yeah, I think I have seen at least pieces of it, and I remember thinking it was pretty cheesy.
Oh, it's on YouTube for free.
Yeah, I think that's where I saw it, was on YouTube.
Yeah, but basically, I thought it would be interesting because they are very, very, like, nitpicky with their details, to be honest. Like, the best example I can think of is there's this jail where Al Capone was heard screaming, saying, like, get away from me and all these other things. And everyone's like, oh my gosh, he was being attacked by ghosts, the people he killed. But they forget to mention this is the time in his life when he had syphilis eating his brain. And
Oh, interesting. Yeah,
when it eats your brain, you get hallucinations. So there's a logical explanation that they don't talk about. And they brought like a psychic on, and the psychic was like, oh, there's three bodies on this property, blah, 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 blah. So it just, it's very fascinating to me how like we take the legend and we ruin it. I can't say the word I want to on radio, but you know what word I'm thinking of. But we take it and we ruin it for like popular consumption. So I'm imagining all these like out of state people going, oh my gosh, like that nunnery, they were crazy.
Yeah, I don't know if I think that they ruin it. I mean, the supernatural is so popular. And I think of, you know, kind of the mass media interest in places like St. Anne's is, you know, I mean, the one thing we know about folklore is that it's passed around, it changes, right? That's a basic dynamic of folklore. And, you know, I think, you know, maybe another way to think about it is that, you know, it's just another retelling of the legend in a different medium. It's as a folklorist, I'm probably a little bit less interested in it than I am the versions that the kids just tell themselves or that my students tell me and things like that, because I'm more interested in the oral tradition. But, you know, the mass media, I think, does have a role, because there's lots of different kinds of folklore that would, you know, probably have died out if it wasn't for, you know, the mass media. And certainly, like, on the internet isn't mass media, you know, that's sort of participatory media, but legends certainly thrive on the internet. You know, the internet explodes with legends. In fact, I think it's one of the problems, you know, this information war that we're having in the United States right now is that, you know, there's just really too many legends circulating.
Yeah.
And they're believable. And unfortunately, people don't have the critical capacity to distinguish, you know, what's half truth from, you know, what is truth, because that's what legends kind of do, is they're sort of like a half, you know, a half truth. They sort of, you know, go between reality and fiction. But anyway, so shows like that, you know, the other thing that they do is they do, I also think of them as a form of tourism, you know, they are bringing attention to a particular place. And I think of legend tripping as kind of a tourism too. You know, the students were doing a little tour of their own, you know, by going up to St. Anne's. And in the same way, you know, the ghost hunter shows go to particular locations that are interesting and they do their own tour, you know, essentially. And sometimes, you know, they will even attract people to the spot. So, you know, if the ghost hunter version gets out and people are attracted to it, then more people come to St. Anne's, and it kind of perpetuates that cycle of legend tripping and legend, you know, in ways too. It's they're not, you know, they're not my main interest, I would say, but I would just say, you know, it's just sort of another way of storytelling in the modern era. And it certainly reaches probably more people being on YouTube than it does, you know, than in the oral versions. The one thing I would have a problem with is if their version on YouTube sort of became the authoritative version, if that was the only one that everybody knew, because
it,
I think it would,
like, most people out of state, that's the only version they have access to.
Yeah. And so if that became, like, you know, everybody thought that that was somehow the correct, you know, idea about St. Anne's. And of course, with folklore, none of the ideas are correct. They're all just versions of ideas that cycle on and cycle on. And so that would be my main concern, is that I wouldn't want it to become like the only version or the more authoritative version.
So I'm gonna say something that might, like, scare you slightly.
Okay.
But I don't think there's going to be any new legends of St. Anne's anytime soon, because, like, none of my friends and no one I know or even know a friend of a friend of has gone to St. Anne's because of we're broke college students. And I don't know if this is true or not, but I heard there's like a $250 fee if you get caught.
There is. That is true. I don't know exactly how much it is, but I know there's a big, well, the person who owns the property right now, I mean, part of the problem is that the property has been quite vandalized over time, right? So again, you know, kids go up there, they drink, things get broken, they break into the house, you know, and the property, the diocese sold the property in 1993 because they didn't have the money to keep it up because it was being vandalized and they couldn't afford to fix, you know, everything that was broken all the time. And they just didn't have the resources. So they sold it to a private property owner. And since then, it's really been kind of, you know, abandoned, which of course then attracts more attention because it's, you know, interesting, these empty houses. People wonder, like, you know, what happened up there. But what was I saying? Oh, but I believe it's the current property owner, or at least this has been like this for about the past 10 years, really does not want anybody up there at all. And so over time, it's become harder to get onto the property. So I think there's razor wire, you know, around pieces of the property. I know that there's been cameras installed so that if you go onto the property, you will actually be, you know, on camera.
I heard the security guards too.
Are there security guards? Yeah, there might be.
I don't know if it's true. I just heard.
Yeah, there might be. There might be.
There might be a floor about like the security of this property.
Yeah, yeah. And I know that, that you know, the owner was sort of asking at one point for people to be identified whom he had caught on tape so that they could be fined for trespassing and things like that. And so that, you know, is really going to discourage, obviously, people from going up there, which is what he wants. In fact, one time, he was really not very friendly. I secured some money from the English department and I wanted to take my students on a tour. And I was like, hey, I've got, you know, a couple hundred dollars. I'll pay you to take my students and me on a tour, you know, so that we're not trespassing. We have your permission. We just want to kind of look and do it in a, you know, in a way that's respectful of the owner. And he just would not give me the time of day. So we never ended up being able to go do it.
That's disappointing.
I was very disappointed because I've never been up there. I don't want to trespass and go up there. I'm a chicken. I'm afraid of getting a fine and getting caught. And I think it would look kind of bad. I know others in my department have done so and are probably more brave than me, but you know,
I'm not getting a fee. I'm
yeah.
broke.
Yeah.
$4.
Yeah. So I think that more than anything else has really kind of discouraged, that tradition of going legend tripping up there. You know, I think people now kind of more drive by it and be like, there it is. But there may be people, you know, you should put it out to your audience and ask them if people still do it.
It also seems like because people don't go up there, people tend to think something really bad happened up there. Like they're like, no one goes up there anymore because of the blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And I think that incident in 1997 with the high school students started that for sure. Because when I was learning about it and asking my students if they still went up there, a few of them did, but a lot of them were like, you know, it's too dangerous. So I think, you know, that real incident in which kids were hurt and certainly frightened and terrorized, you know, really, really, really did put a damper on it.
Yeah. And you can't use the phone in the canyon. So.
What's it? Yeah. And you can't use your cell phone. So there's
a damper on that.
There is that for sure. For sure. I'm trying to think if there's any, any other aspects that I wanted to talk. I think we hit on a lot of them, so.
Well, I just have one quick question. Do you have a favorite telling? If you do, will you tell it to us?
Let's see. Do I have a favorite telling? Well, I can kind of summarize one that I put in my article if you want me to do that.
Sure, go for it.
Storyteller. Would that be okay?
Yeah. Right.
Let me see if I can find it. Let's see. I had to look at that article before this thing. Okay, so here's kind of an interesting one. This one's from 1981. And it says, St. Anne's used to be an old nunnery, and I love this. It's a sin for nuns to have kids. Well, there was a camp up there, and there was a couple of nuns that did have kids. The mother nun, so this is the mother superior, I don't know what they call them, found out about the babies, so she stole them one night and threw them in the swimming pool to drown them. She threw them in the pool, and that same night, the whole place burned down. So there's that idea about, you know, the whole thing burning down that I was talking about. From what I hear, the nuns aren't permitted up there anymore. They aren't supposed to go up there, and they closed it all down. I don't know if the nuns are left or if they're still in the valley. The original name of that mother was Saint Hecata. There's supposed to be some dogs sitting there watching for the witch. The witch is named Hecata, and if you ever go up there, you're supposed to hear their chains, be able to hear them their chains or hear them bark. So I think that one's pretty good, just because it it has almost all of it, like, into one story. You know? Yeah, like I don't think there's anything they left out, except obviously that telling was recorded before the 97 incident. So, you know, the archives are full of stories for any, you know, of your audience who's interested in it. The Fife Folklore Archives has hundreds of St. Anne's stories. And in fact, the library put together a really nice exhibit on St. Anne's a couple of years ago. My only thing that I don't like is they tend to spell Anne with an E, A-N-N-E. And it's really supposed to be A-N-N. That was what the church had named it. So when you talk about St. Anne's, make sure you don't put the E on there.
I won't put the E. I'll put right
A-N-N.
And without an E.
Yeah. But when you go to the archives, you find it both ways. But actually in the archives, a lot of times it's an E, but that wasn't the original spelling. That's sort of a local variant.
Hecata, that sounds familiar to me. Is that an actual like witch from the Middle Ages or something?
Greek goddess.
Oh, magic, right?
Yeah, and magic and the crossroads, and I think she's got dogs that protect her, so there's those hounds again.
Oh, yep, someone got creative.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is that's interesting is there may have been, and I've never been able to fully, determine this through research, but there may have already been stories in Logan Canyon about Hecata. Like,
really?
Before the whole nunnery thing started. And so I think what might have happened is that there was already kind of ghost stories in the canyon, maybe about a witch named Hecata. And then those got kind of put onto St. Anne's after it became a Catholic retreat. So that is my hypothesis, though. It's nothing proven, and I don't actually really know. It would take a lot more archival research and digging around.
That'd be a cool theory.
What's that? Yeah, it sounds good anyway.
Yeah. And anything else you want to mention? Other than don't break in, we don't condone on you breaking into the St. Anne's, but if you do, you should talk to the folklore professor.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, or you know,
if you've gotten
in, invite me along because I want to go. Yeah. You know, if anybody,
your mask.
Yeah.
Oh, we're already wearing masks. Like, wear another mask on top of your mask.
That's right. Yeah, I guess you know, the only thing that I would say is I love St. Anne's. Like, I love the folklore complex around it. You know, the whole thing is just fascinating to me. I do find it in some ways kind of a sad story. Sad because I feel like, you know, this was a beautiful property at one point in the 20s and 30s, you know, that's just sort of declined over the years. And I feel really, if I had, you know, all the money in the world, I would probably buy St. Anne's and renovate those cabins, because I think those cabins are, you know, were probably really gorgeous.
English department.
Yeah, at one point the English would have to pay me a lot more though to do it. You know, I think also the stories are really fun, you know, there's kind of a cautionary note in there about how to characterize different groups of people. You know, I do kind of feel sorry for those nuns that they felt unsafe there, so much so that they had to have dogs, and that eventually that the church sold it because of the vandalism. So, you know, legends are kind of powerful stories, and I think that it's lucky that those kids who got caught by those by the caretakers in the 90s and 1997. I think it's lucky that it wasn't worse. You know, I feel like the power of narrative is such that it might have been a lot worse for them. So I would just say, be careful with the legends. You know, we don't want to mess around with them. They are powerful tools. So awesome. I think that's it.
Thank you for talking to us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for asking me. I appreciate it.
If you want to look into this yourself, I suggest you look it through the archives. The archivists are very fun and nice to get to know. Not to mention, this particular collection that we've been discussing tonight is housed online, at least a part of it, so you can look up the legends yourself. Just go to the archives website, linked in the description. If you're interested in this, please check out the archives website. It's linked to the USU Libraries website. If there's something you want us to check out in particular, please Aggie Radio email displayed on our website. See you guys next time.